Welcome back to the Huntsville Craftcast. I'm Anna.
I'm Anthony.
And I'm John.
Last year for Women in Horror Month, we brought you the hard-hitting topic of representation in the world of horror for women that really needed to be addressed. So this year, we thought we'd lighten things up a bit by doing what this month is really all about and celebrating just a few of the many women who we feel need recognition and celebration.
I love that we try to hit different topics every year whenever we do Women in Horror Month, and it's great, Anna, that you get to kind of like lead us into all the episodes. So I'm really excited to be just diving into it again.
Yeah, I don't know nothing about women.
And that's why I married you. So yeah, it's really hard to narrow down women to talk about whenever we do these episodes, because there's just so many of them. And I remember the first time that we ever did a Women in Horror Month episode for the podcast, and it ended up being about 3 hours long because we just could not stop going, oh, wait a minute, this woman too, which is why we usually try and theme all of them. But this year we were just like, no, we need some women behind the scenes that we just feel need recognition, or like women we've just learned about in some cases.
But that's also where, like, I hate the buzzwordiness of, like, sure, okay, Women in Horror Month, but as soon as you start trying to like vaguely research women in horror, the first couple of topics are, why are there no female directors? Who are the women in horror? There are so many amazing people that we get to talk about. And that's why I do love doing this episode, because like, okay, cool, we're going to highlight some cool stuff that you're probably not paying enough attention to.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, people are very much under the impression that women are not involved in horror. And the general public probably just doesn't realize how many women are involved in horror and how instrumental they've been, you know, from creature design to directing to writing. You know, they are woven into the fabric of everything that is horror. So it's great to be able to celebrate them whenever we can.
And I also will make the point before we start as well that feminism is intersectional, or if it's not feminism. So that just goes without saying whenever we are talking about women in horror. That means all women. It's not select to a certain type of femininity that is very toxic.
You talk about J.K. Rowling?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't going to name names, but you know.
We're here to name names. She's not a woman in horror. We're not celebrating her this month.
We're not. But that should go for just every genre. And I think the horror community are very good at being real feminists.
Yeah, being horror, accepting, being a loving of all.
Yes.
Horror is now and always has been the most socially conscious and aware and progressive genre.
But Anthony, horror's woke now.
Yeah, okay. Horror is woke and elevated horror is a genre.
Yeah.
Stop watching Fox News and please watch the horror films.
So who are we starting off with?
I don't mind starting us off. Like I said, it was really hard to narrow people down, but
I mean, the goal is not narrowed down, it's just like the 45 minutes that we have your attention, if that, these are the ones we're going to talk about.
Yeah,
right. So the first person I wanted to talk about is Veronica France, and she is the writer and director for both The Lodge and Goodnight Mummy, as well as having 17 writer credits, 7 director credits. She does a whole bunch, but The Lodge and Goodnight Mummy are just such good films. And the way that she works with another filmmaker called Severin Fiala, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And they actually met because he used to babysit for her 2 sons. And then they just got talking about horror and like wanting to filmmake. And they were eventually like, hey, let's just write and direct some horror movies together, which I kind of love. And I mean, for like your first real like horror movies that you write and direct to be The Lodge and Goodnight Mommy, yeah. Which are two of like the most outstanding films we've had in the last decade.
Yeah.
It's insane. But also I just love the fact that she is a mother, and both The Lodge and Goodnight Mommy are about the dynamic of 2 kids with a mother figure.
I haven't seen Goodnight Mommy, but that dynamic in The Lodge, absolutely highlights the terrifying elements of parenthood, and especially in the protagonist's case in that one, kind of step-parenthood.
Yeah, yeah. Step-parenthood is the most terrifying parenthood you can do. So if yeah. you are a good step-parent, you are incredible, just yeah. to let you know.
I didn't know that she was, you know, a mom of two children herself, and like being a parent myself, that just adds a whole other layer of appreciation onto what she's done, you know, especially with Goodnight Mommy, just like just adding parenthood on as another layer to horror storytelling is something that fascinates me now. And the way that it's done in Goodnight Mommy, where it's very alien, you're seeing that added layer of parenthood, and just the way that sometimes a parent and a child will look at each other like they're like either one is very alien to the other is just so fascinating. And she represents that fear and just strangeness of parenthood so well in both of those movies.
Definitely. And especially like in, because in Goodnight Mommy, which I wasn't expecting much from when I first saw it, because I thought from the trailer that I knew all what was going to happen.
Right, right, right.
And the way it played out was just so much more psychological than I thought. And it's such yeah. a, you're almost seeing the horror from a child's perspective. Whereas in The Lodge, you're seeing it from a parent perspective very much, yeah. where especially from a step-parent coming in, but also this goes for all parents. There are times, I'm not even a parent, and I know that there are times when your kids are acting up so much that you feel like they're fucking with you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you're like, my kids want to kill me.
Yeah.
Are they like, you get, cause you're tired and you're irrational. And sometimes when your kids are acting up, and this is just from a perspective of looking after my family's kids, you're like, does this kid literally hate me right now? And is yeah. trying to conspire against me, because that's how it feels. And that film plays on that fear as a parent, but especially as a step parent.
It does it so well. And it like, it's no wonder that people believed in the myth of changelings for so long, because it really does feel like that sometimes, where it's like, this is a completely different child. You've come and completely replaced who my kid was.
Why did you say believed past tense?
Anthony still believes.
Yeah, are you kidding me? Kids are super weird, and I would not be surprised if like one day we just go out and like, I don't know, Jax goes into the woods, comes back, and like, we don't know if that's Jax. I've seen too many of these movies, John.
I know.
I'm yeah. suspicious of his motives as is.
That kid's way too smart, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah. Anytime we talk about psychological horror and the roles of women in film, it really brings me back to Shirley Jackson. Like, obviously, Mary Shelley is the mother of horror and has kind of started all of this off with Frankenstein. But then in the 60s, Shirley Jackson really hit it home with making psychological horror like the foremost read genre of that time period. And she was one of the first people to really delve into a woman's perspective and inner monologue in that psychological horror genre. And I think as much as we've seen all of these new iterations of The Haunting of Hill House, and as much as like The Lodge is much more turn of the screw than it is Hill House, it does still kind of fall under that category. It does still fall under that. There is something strange happening here. Is it the people or is it the place? And it's just really great to have Shirley Jackson's original story give us a deeper look into the psyche of somebody who's going through that at that time. I think we lose that in some of the later iterations of these Hill House type stories. So it's nice to have somebody bring that back into the forefront and make psychological horror more of an internal monologue, more of this internal battle than so much pomp and metaphor.
Definitely. And yeah, the adaptations of Shirley Jackson's work so far have not really lived up to the book, apart from maybe We've Always Lived in the Castle comes a bit close.
Oh my God.
That was good.
I don't know why I was going straight into Hill House here, but We Have Always Lived in the Castle is one of my favorite books. And there is so much of that contested castle motif in We Have Always Lived in the Castle, in that you have these two girls who are essentially living on their own. They live with their uncle, but he's neither here nor there. But there is a level of that internal monologue of what is expected of a woman's role in the home, and this societal pressure of the people that they live in this town with, who are just absolutely awful. And to see that portrayed so well in Stacey Passon's version in 2018, to have a female director at the helm bringing Shirley Jackson's work to light, I think this is probably the best Shirley Jackson adaptation that we've ever had.
Yeah, I think if Hill House had been directed by a woman, it might be different.
I haven't... Are you talking about the movies, the TV series?
TV series.
I mean, there's like 10 episodes. Some of them might have been.
Yeah, that's true.
I haven't looked enough into it. That's so much more to John's point of why it's so important to have women behind the scenes as much as it is to have them in these leading roles, in these female performers. My whole spark in this month has been from Anna and I recently watching the film Suitable Flesh. It's an adaptation of a Lovecraft story, The Thing at the Doorstep. And it does do a lot of variations where, like, it took me a minute to realize it was The Thing at the Doorstep, but it's a fun, good adaptation. Barbara Crampton does a great job in this film, and it really brings me back to her origins in that she has become this face of Lovecraftian horror. If you're making Lovecraftian horror and you don't have Barbara Crampton in it, you're not making Lovecraftian horror. And the big thing for me at this was, I'm watching it, I'm enjoying it, and in the end credits I see, produced by Barbara Crampton. And it got me thinking, we don't talk enough, one, about producers in general, and like realistically, like that's the shot caller, that's who's like making these movies happen. Right. So to have female producers calling the shots and saying, yeah, hey, here's how we're going to do this. We're making Lovecraftian horror. That's a fantastic thing. And so I was like, oh, cool. Like, I want to see who else is like really producing in this realm. And to see that Barbara Crampton not only did this, but she also produced the remake of Castle Freak after having been in the original Castle Freak. That's so cool. That's such a full circle moment for somebody who is helming these Lovecraftian horror films from the inception of her career to where she is now. And I got like a special place in my heart for Barbara Crampton because we are cut from the same cloth almost entirely. Grew up on Long Island, raised by circus folk, loves theater. That's my girl. So yeah, Barbara Crampton kind of sparked me down this rabbit hole. And this takes me a little bit deeper. I'm gonna deep cut y'all a little bit. I know that we talk about that one stupid thing that Jason Blum said back in like 2018, which he like very quickly reneged on. And we have seen Blumhouse do better since then. Jeanette Volturno is a producer who predominantly does Blumhouse films. And I started deep diving her career and her films. She's got like 100 films under her belt. And some of them are things that like are really solid, things that we know and we've enjoyed. And like some of the better Blumhouse films were done under her producing.
I mean, obviously that's very ironic for what Jason Blum was saying, because likely she was working on stuff when he said like, oh yeah, there's not really many females in, or women who work in horror. So, you know, it's really hard to find them. And she was probably standing there while he was doing that being like, hey buddy, remember me on your staff? Anyway, but as much as I shit on Blumhouse for that statement, and not just that statement, but, you know, there's always going to be a Blumhouse film that you love, and there's always going to be a Blumhouse film that you hate. And
I mean, that's the thing, really. They're taking chances on a lot of new IP and a lot of new people. So credit where credit is due.
I mean, which Blumhouse film, is there a couple of Blumhouse films that you know that she did that I can figure out whether I like them or not, because that might change my perspective on Blumhouse.
So I don't remember exactly if Hush was Blumhouse, but she did executive produce on it.
Okay, I love her.
And we rave about Hush on this podcast all the time.
So good. Yeah.
That is where like Mike Flanagan peaked. That's where, you know, we have Jeanette Volturno being the yes person on this film.
I forgot that Mike Flanagan did that because I hate everything else he does.
No, we hate when he adapts things. I think he's great when
Isn't he doing everything else that he's done?
He does do mostly adaptations. Yeah. I can't remember whether or not you loved or hated this one, John, but Ouija Origin of Evil.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah.
I couldn't remember if it was that or the other
that
Ouija movie.
That one blew the original Ouija movie out of the water.
Yeah, stylized, 1970s.
Yeah.
So cool.
It fits it so well.
Universally beloved Happy Death Day.
Amazing.
I haven't seen it.
Which is a film
I lied that about universally yeah. beloved. I love it. Anna loves it. John, get with the program. Our producer on this episode, Grim Cryptex, also loves Happy Death Day.
And that's also being really important to have produced from the female perspective.
That and Freaky.
Oh, also very important. My God, that if you're going to have to be really tiptoeing on a woman's perspective to put on a film, then Freaky is the one.
She did produce on Halloween Kills, so we'll forgive her. Yikes. I mean, I get it.
I've already forgotten Halloween Kills.
They can't all be gems. They can't all be gems. It's all right. Evil
but they
Dice
can be
Knight.
Gem in the Holograms, which she did produce.
Oh, what an angel.
So that's really my point for this episode, is how far behind the scenes we're willing to look. How far are we willing to pull that curtain to see, yes, women are pulling the strings in this genre and for very important movies.
For very movies, important
stories.
Movies and, yeah, movies, stories, just, I mean, it's someone on the same sort of level, or like you normally mention them within the same sort of breath, right? When you're talking about the storied history that they have in film, when you mention Barbara Crampton, you also have to think of Heather Langenkamp. I mean, you know, she is our Nancy. you know, we love her from the Elm Street films. And for a long time, that is how everyone knew her. And we could spend hours, I'm sure, talking about her impact, you know, within that film series alone. But it's her work after acting that really makes her someone that I wanted to bring up in this episode. You know, she did step away from acting mostly. She did make a pretty cool comeback, I thought, in Mike Flanagan. I know I am a fanboy. I'm sorry, guys. Mike Flanagan's Midnight Club, which I loved.
Also an adaptation.
Also an adaptation.
I haven't actually watched Midnight Club, so I can't say anything about
it. It's great. And what I loved was that he was able to put someone who is so beloved, like Heather Langenkamp, into that role, and how she kind of embodied, you know, the sort of evil doctors in Elm Street 3, and how she's sort of a secret villain, you know, spoiler alert, within that series.
Well, now I don't have to watch it. Thanks, John.
But when we also talk about her work behind the scenes, it's her involvement in AFX Studios that is so incredible. You know, her and her husband have led this effects house and have worked on so many big films. And she's basically helping to give other people and other women, of course, a chance in the film industry by, you know, putting those effects in their films. And I just,
especially to encourage practical effects in this day and age.
Oh, yeah.
That's, we love a good practical effect. Give me a good monster any day.
Oh, yeah. But it's the, that passing of the torch, if you will, of someone who, you know, is one of the most revered final girls in all of horror, to now say, all right, I'm going to help you, to put it in wrestling terms, to get over, you know, with your projects now. And I think that's so important. And it's what I love about the horror community, is that everyone wants to help everyone else. You know, we do want to kind of champion new creatives, and that she's doing her part in that is great, I think.
Definitely. And yeah, bringing practical effects to life in this day and age is a superhero move on its own.
It's also very reminiscent of Millicent Patrick, just taking it straight back to, you know, one of the first people that we talk about getting overlooked in the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting overlooked in the industry is a huge thing that women have to deal with. And that actually reminds me of another person I was going to mention, Stephanie Rothman. So she worked on films like Velvet Vampire, which is fantastic, Bloodbath, It's a Bikini World, The Student Nurses, like these B-movie exploitation films that I'm sure people have seen come up on.
I've only seen Velvet Vampire.
But that, for me, that's my personal favorite. So I think that's the best one to watch out of any of them if you're going to watch them. But she, after she finished film school, she was the first woman to be awarded the Directors Guild of America Fellowship, which is given to one student per year in the world. And she was the first female to get it.
That rules.
Yeah. And this was back in the 1950s that she graduated. So yeah, like, that's huge on its own. And in 1960, she started working for the infamous Roger Corman, who launched her into the world of these exploitation B-movies that he was also known for. And while she was there, she actually I can't remember the name of the director who is given credit first for Bloodbath, that worked on it with Roger Corman. But basically, Roger wasn't happy with it when it had finished. Look at me saying Roger like I know him. Yeah, you know my buddy Roger.
I just said that Barbara Crampton was, quote unquote, my girl. Yeah. So
okay. So me and good old Rog. So Roger Corman wasn't happy with the way that it turned out. So he asked Stephanie Rothman to reshoot and redirect a whole bunch of that movie. And eventually she was credited as the co-director, but it took a while and it's just like, come on, man. And I don't know if that was Roger Corman's fault. It was someone's fault for just not giving her the credit where credit was due.
Usually some producer somewhere.
Yeah, usually
some, and that's why it's important to have producers who understand how important representation is.
Definitely, and especially in that time. But eventually she left working with Roger Corman because he wanted to... he helped her a lot in her film career. And when they did The Student Nurses, which is one of her films, that went really well. So Roger Corman wanted to do another one. And she said, no, I don't want to do it, because the way that he wanted to redo it kind of was, or do the sequel was kind of way too exploitative. Exploitative, that's right, right?
Yeah.
Exploitative. And so she was like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. And so she wanted to get out of doing exploitation movies. And her husband did go and work for Dimension Pictures for a long time. But she spent 10 years of her career writing and putting herself out there, being like, oh, can we do this type of movie? And everyone's going, oh yeah, you're Stephanie Rothman, known for these B movies. Let's do a B movie. And she's like, no, here's the script for a film that I want to do that's a more serious horror. And no one would take her in unless she was willing to go back to doing B-movie, exploitation movies. So she finally gave up and left the industry, which is really sad. But that's a great legacy to leave. And it's just so sad that she ended up just giving up. Because like, if it was this day and age, she would be out there doing so much. And I wish that we had access to all of the things that she was trying to put out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been great to see what it was that she wanted to work on and where her passion really lied in those later years.
I do like that acknowledgement of her role did come out later. I mean, you know, too little too late, but at least it happened, better late than never. And we're constantly seeing things like that, just like how it feels like only recently people really started talking about Millicent Patrick. Obviously, I do all my witchy stuff and my tarot reading and whatever, but like also only recently we're starting to see people talk about Pamela Coleman Smith, who, when you talk about tarot cards, the Rider-Waite is the quintessential deck that everybody knows. And just recently it started officially being called the Rider-Waite Smith, attributing Pamela Coleman Smith's original artwork back to her.
Was she the one who did the artwork?
She did have a lot of involvement in the artwork and the interpretation of the cards originally.
That's crazy. I didn't know
but
that.
So much of it was attributed to everybody involved but her.
Yeah. No, it's sad. But what I do really like seeing now is that we're at the stage where women are working with other men or people in a team and still getting the same recognition as the other people in the teams.
Yeah.
Like with Veronica Franz, who I mentioned before, like she works in a team with her friend and she still gets just as much recognition. And then the other person that comes to mind is Anuka Whistle, who is part of the Roadkill Superstars, who did, which is a team of free filmmakers. And they did Summer of 84 and Turbo Kid and all that good juicy stuff.
Shut the fuck up. Is that what they call themselves or is that like their...
No, that's their production company.
Why have I never paid attention to this? That rules.
It's so cool.
Also didn't put two and two together that they were 84 and Turbo Kid.
Oh, yeah. And when you think about it, you suddenly go, oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But they've done so many films together. And
nostalgia served up on a blood-soaked platter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that one of the other guys in the group is her brother. And obviously, me being completely attached at the hip with my three brothers, like, that's a dream, going out and making films with your brothers and with your friends, but also getting the same recognition as the men in the group. I love that so much. It's progress.
It is progress. And I love sort of like we're talking about the reappraisal of, you know, women's roles in films where they hadn't really been credited before, or maybe they weren't getting the credit that they deserved. Someone who unfortunately went through a lot of that was Rae Hance, who her birth name was Heather Donahue, who we might all know from the Blair Witch Project. And you know, obviously back in the day, the Razzies were, you know, a lot bigger than they are now. And when,
I forgot about them for a minute.
But it was just, you know, she got the shit end of the stick, you know, being one of the main focuses in the Blair Witch Project, being, you know, one of the main characters, and was given a Razzie for, you know, worst performance of the year. So it's really shitty when you think of the history of the Blair Witch Project that she had that credit to her name. And for a long time, the attachment of her birth name to that movie was something that kind of just really weighed on her. You know, she had done a phenomenal job bringing the character of Heather Donahue to life and putting her actual name out there, that she really couldn't detach from the negative press that came along with it, as well as just some of the history behind it. And as she went on, she eventually wound up leaving acting and became a marijuana farmer, and, you know, has written books on it and everything, and wanted to create some of that separation there. She wound up changing her name to Rae Hance in 2020. But what I found really interesting, and kind of like giving justice to her performance and giving that credit where credit's due and allowing herself to have a say in her own legacy, is the team behind the Blair Witch Project sequel, or the third Blair Witch Project movie, when they wanted to have a connection to Heather's character from the original movie in that third installment, they actually went to her for permission to use her name and said, "We are not going to use your full last name. We're not going to use your last name in the film at all. You're just going to be referred to as Heather, or my sister." And so she was allowed to, she gave permission. So that was her kind of just taking the power back and allowing herself to have a place in her own story and a say in her own legacy. And I just think that's really cool that she got that moment, that she was able to get that kind of reappraisal. And a lot of nowadays, a lot more praise than what she was getting when the movie was first released.
Yeah, I can't imagine how difficult that would be, having to live with. I didn't realize that she'd used her birth name as her character name.
Yeah.
And I remember the criticism that Blair Witch Project got back in the 90s. Like, I remember everyone was mimicking that performance of the nose, and like, it was in everything.
Yeah.
And I didn't appreciate the Blair Witch Project for a long time until I figured out what it was actually about.
Mm-hmm. Debatable still.
Still debatable, but
I
prefer that theory of it not being about the Blair Witch.
Yeah.
Because my God, that's actually genius.
Yeah.
If that's how they intended that film to be.
Then you have to disregard the sequel.
I disregard all sequels most of the time. If I really
Blair
like
Witch 2, Book of Shadows is phenomenal. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I fucking love that movie.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not.
No.
Okay.
Wholeheartedly.
Maybe I'll give it a watch.
But yeah, a lot of the criticism that came the movie's way was lobbed at Heather.
Right, which is dumb, because like, her performance was obviously better than the guys in it, but also like, it's what made it iconic.
Exactly. It's right, what
you
made it iconic.
Parody that if it's not really hitting the social whatever, like, being put out there for everyone to see and have some kind of connection to.
Right. I mean, it just think about her audition for the Blair Witch Project. As part of the audition, the filmmakers asked everyone auditioning, they went right into this role play and said, "You are up for parole today. You're here before this parole board. Why should we let you out of prison?" She was the only person to respond with, "You shouldn't let me out." And that stunned the filmmakers, and that's what won her the role. So, I mean, I'm just so happy that she's gotten the praise that she's so well deserved, as well as had that opportunity to take her name back and kind of have that power back in her hands.
Especially in her lifetime, because so often when those moments come around, it is too little too late.
Yep.
Definitely. And women taking their power back is the best thing you can do.
Yo, next Women in Horror episode?
What, taking your power back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why we needed this lighter one, because last year I think we kind of kicked everyone in the feels a little bit, and taking your power back is going to be a real strong one. So next year we'll kick everyone in the face again. But the point of this episode was just that there's so many women behind and in front of the screen that just don't, people just kind of don't think about. And yeah. every time I watch a movie, I always try and look up at least the writer and the director.
Well, I think that is kind of a little bit the problem that we have as a general audience member, the two things that they're looking at are writer and director. I mean, we could go on and on about, you know, women who have done incredible sound design or every element of what goes into making a film truly stand out.
Oh, yeah. I think on our first Women in Horror episode, I went on for about half an hour about the female set designer of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right. So I think just as audience members, whether it is for really any role, we should be looking at those credits more and more and appreciating how much goes into making a film what it is, how many people have to come together under the same ideas to bring something to life cohesively. And that's what makes a good film great.
Definitely. And anyone who has directed a movie before should, well, at least I felt this while I was directing a movie, is...
Can we talk about that a little?
About what?
Your experience as a woman in horror director now that you have two films under your belt?
Well, no, I was going to say, like, anyone who has directed and has the same emotions as I do is, like, I hope, perpetually thankful for every single person who works on that movie, because I spent the whole time feeling guilty for putting my name as director and wanted to kind of give the credit to absolutely everyone in the room. I don't know if I'm just like special in that way for thinking like that, but everything's not down to the director. Everyone makes a movie what it is. Yeah. And my two movies wouldn't be what they are if everyone hadn't worked on them. Everyone would just be walking around a room and then there would be nothing on film, which is good because it means that we all have something to contribute. And especially when writing, I think it's so important. And that's why the women I mentioned working with men, especially, or just other people, is so important, because it's important to get everyone's perspective. And you need a woman there to be like, no, a girl wouldn't do that. Or like, that's not our experience. Don't right. try and write for us. Whereas men can say exactly the same. They can be like, actually, no, growing up, that's not what being a teenage boy was like. Yeah. Or like, this isn't speaking for us. Right. Or like,
I'm gonna super simplify this in when, as somebody with siblings, you can tell when a writer does not have siblings by the way that they have this insistence on referring to other characters, bro and sis.
I don't know. I say hey bro to all of my bros.
You were written by an only child.
My brothers text me every day, they go, hey sis. But we don't say it in person, only through text. I don't know. But maybe we got that from movies. I don't know.
The most that I refer to my brothers as brother is because of that one pig meme where the pig goes, brother, may I have some oats or whatever.
Okay, now that explains why you say stuff like that to your brothers all the time. Yeah, you can definitely tell when someone hasn't got the same experience, which I think is why it's good that everyone from every different background contributes to movies and is respected all equally in the same way. And yeah, and that brings me back to the point of feminism being intersectional. Everyone needs to be included on this for it to be equal and to be fair. And just by having Women in Horror Month doesn't mean that men or any other gender are left out of the equation. It just means that we need more celebrating because we've not been celebrated for such a long time. So just give us this one. It's a scary world.
Speaking of scary worlds, do you want your fear of the day?
Let's do it.
I guess.
You guys are going to be so mad. I just discovered this one, so you guys have to also. Zemophobia.
Is it fear of women?
No.
Thank God.
I think we've done that one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You're afraid of Zem ladies.
No.
Zemophobia, like Z-E-M?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fear of strong women?
No,
nothing to do with women.
Part of the reason you guys are going to be mad is because it doesn't have to do with the episode. It's just a fear that I discovered. And I mean, a word for it exists, which means it exists, which means at least one person in the world has this. And if one person has it, more people probably have it. And I want to meet them.
Oh my God. Okay, what is it?
Zemophobia is the fear of the great mole rat.
Oh, no.
Wow. Wow, that's really disconnected from anything we were talking about.
I told you you were going to be mad.
Did you just equate women to mole rats?
Don't do this to me, Grim.
During Women in Horror Month? Nice.
Wow, I really can't get over that phobia. That's really, that really threw me off.
Do you want to give us our recommendation?
Yes, sorry. So our joint recommendation, for this Women in Horror Month is The Love Witch, from director Annabella Biller.
I think so.
Thank you. Edit that bit out, please. If you haven't seen The Love Witch already, I'm sure you have heard about it because it blew up, and for damn good reason.
The film is beautiful.
It's so gorgeous. Yeah. It's the closest to a 70s feeling film that's not filmed in the 70s that we've had. And it's all about
it's about reclaiming your power.
It's about reclaiming your power. And yeah, it's so important. And, it's very much all from the female perspective. And I just very much love that.
I do love that that's a recommendation this month, also because Anna Biller just put out a book called Bluebeard's Castle, which does harken back to those classic Bluebeard stories, which is among the first folk horrors, I guess, to really deal with that idea of the contested castle. And I would love for us to do a Bluebeard episode. Talk about all the movies that are Bluebeard adjacent,
yeah,
and what that actually translates into.
Definitely. It's not just about being about pirates.
It's not about pirates at all.
No, but people are going to think that Bluebeard is a pirate thing.
Because Blackbeard is a pirate?
Exactly.
I hate that.
Okay. Wait, did no one think for a second when they heard Bluebeard?
I did.
Thank you.
All right.
I know my people.
I know my folklore.
Happy Women in Horror Month, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Hauntsville Cryptcast. I'm Anna.
I'm Anthony.
And I'm John.
Happy haunting!